The next case for this morning is Relational, LLC against Robert Hodges. Mr. Graham?
May it please the Court? Your Honors, this is a case that amounts to a swearing contest between Mr. Hodges and Ms. Johns, the process server. And the problem with what's happened in this case is that the court set up a schedule to have an evidentiary hearing and told the parties to have your witnesses there.
Let me ask you whether there's any reason to think that Mr. Hodges was not served in accordance with the law of the United Kingdom.
Your Honor, we have not looked at that issue.
Well, that's an important issue because Rule 4F is the rule that governs serving an individual in a foreign country, and I'm quite sure that this was not Hague Service Convention service, but the rule goes on to permit under F2 that if there's no agreement, it's also all right to serve as prescribed by the foreign country's law for service in that country in an action in its courts of general jurisdiction. So the reason I ask that in part is because at this hearing, we do have the man who runs the company that was engaged by Relational, and he is, I would imagine, competent to testify about ordinary methods of service. And secondly, your argument seems to think that the federal court in the Northern District of Illinois has subpoena power over a citizen of the United Kingdom while she's in the United Kingdom, and we don't.
Your Honor, I appreciate your point on that. That's not what I think. The point that I was trying to make is that the court made clear that he thought, that Judge Kaur thought, that the two key witnesses are Mr. Hodges and Ms. Johns.
He thought it would be helpful to have Ms. Johns there, no question, but it's also the fact that she's unavailable. She might as well be dead as far as the courts of the United States are concerned, because we have no power over subjects of foreign countries as she is. And so the court was entitled to look at her initial affidavit of service, in which she affies that she served Mr. Hodges personally and that he identified himself as Mr. Hodges, which doesn't suffer from any of the flaws that you're criticizing the second one of. And the judge also arguably has authority to look at the second document, even though it doesn't happen to satisfy U.S. standards for notarizing, but all it does is actually add the physical description. I'm not sure that it's even all that important once he has satisfied himself with the testimony of the man who did come that this was service as it's normally done in the United Kingdom.
Your Honor, I think the issue here, though, in part, is the process or the framework for analyzing the problem, analyzing whether there was sufficient evidence to show whether Mr. Hodges provided sufficient evidence to rebut the first affidavit. And I think your point is correct by focusing on the first affidavit. I think that is the crux of the matter here.
And the first affidavit, as far as I can tell, is something that the judge was entitled to rely on, and there was nothing in the second affidavit or document, whatever you want to call it, that was not obvious to the viewer. We've all looked at it. You can see it for what it is. So you were rather late in the game making the objection that you're now making to it. It's never been notarized. It's not like this is a feature of the document that arose after the hearing.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. In terms of late in the game, I'm not sure what you're referring to on that.
Well, it's your motion for reconsideration that you raise all this stuff.
Well, no, Your Honor. I objected to the affidavit at the hearing. The court, look.
But you were objecting because Ms. Johns wasn't there.
I was objecting.
You were not focusing on the fact that there was no notary signature on it.
Your Honor, both sides submitted briefs on this case. In this case, we submitted our brief in October. We submitted three affidavits in support of that brief, including Mr. Hodges' affidavit, the grandmother's affidavit, and the aunt's affidavit.
And why was Judge Kaur required to believe your affidavits as opposed to the process server's affidavit?
He's not necessarily required to believe my client's affidavits, but
given your client's record, I can certainly imagine that he was not required.
Your Honor, but what the process that we went through was that in November, a month after our submission, they submitted their papers. There was no affidavit attached to their papers. There was one affidavit attached to their papers. The one affidavit was the process server's original affidavit. They didn't submit any supplemental affidavit at that point.
And all I'm saying is, suppose, just to indulge me, that what they submitted the first time is sufficient in any court of the United Kingdom to support service of process. Then that's full compliance with Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 4F.
But Your Honor, I don't think it's consistent with the opinions of Homer versus Jones Bay, and the opinion Robinson Engineering versus George.
I don't think it's inconsistent with those, and I don't think that they deal with the particular kind of issues we have here, where you've got the problem of serving outside the country.
I think the issue that what those cases point out is the procedure. They talk about the procedure, especially Homer versus Jones Bay. In that case, the Seventh Circuit recognizes that there's a problem when you have a bare-bones affidavit, and that's followed by affidavits denying service.
And hers is not bare-bones. She says in her first affidavit, which is the one I want to focus on,
yes, Your Honor,
that Mr. Hodges answered the door. And as a matter of fact, the judge has other evidence that that was a good address, since Mr. Hodges has chosen to give that address to the company's authorities in the United Kingdom. So the judge is entitled to take that fact into account as well.
But the judge also finds in his opinion, he says that there's the very real possibility that that was not Mr. Hodges' residence. When he says that on page...
That doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't Mr. Hodges at the door, though. Mr. Hodges gave that address. It's owned by a member of his family. That everybody concedes. Whether he hangs out there a lot or not is obviously at issue, but the judge has a fair amount of evidence, and I just and your assumption that every country handles notarizing the same way we do, every country handles service the same way we do, is just not borne out.
The notarizing issue, Your Honor, and the issues related to the second affidavit, which I'll just touch on briefly because you raised it, that's an evidentiary issue for the governed by the cases in Seventh Circuit based on the U.S. courts. It's not a service issue. And the first affidavit...
The Seventh Circuit has never said that we think that all countries on the planet need to follow U.S. law. We wouldn't say such a silly thing.
You're asking a different question, I think, or I'm misinterpreting it. The question you first asked was whether whether to admit an affidavit into evidence, it needs to be notarized. It's clear, based on Seventh Circuit law, based on U.S. law, that the affidavit has to be notarized or it has to be sworn to under penalty of perjury.
Even if you're right and we have only one affidavit properly before us, the first one, which was notarized, that's enough for the prima facie case of valid service, and that prima facie case has to be overcome by credible evidence. And as I read the district court's written decision on this, the judge is rejecting your client's testimony as not credible, and we don't second-guess those kinds of findings.
Yeah, but in this case, Your Honor, what happened at the hearing is the judge had the hearing. We were the only party to put on evidence.
That doesn't matter. If the judge rejects the credibility of your principal witness then you lose. You don't overcome the prima facie case.
And to some extent, Your Honor, this gets back to the procedure that Homer versus Jones Bay laid out. the way I think the court has to look at this is they provided an evidence that provided prima facie proof of service. That's the first affidavit.
Let me ask you something.
Yes.
I'm going to tell you what I think trial judges look at service issues. I think, I might be wrong, but I think most trial judges are influenced by the fact that a defendant is trying to dodge service. And that's what it looks like happened here. He leaves, he doesn't leave a forwarding address, so on. He just leaves the country. So he's trying to, now when he come down to a service issue, he says, oh, I couldn't have been there. I was in Elliot's Punch's pub or something at the time that's written on this service or certificate. The judge doesn't believe that. That, to me, ought to be the end of the case.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think the facts are as you've characterized them in terms of his dodging service. He did leave the country. His business failed. He left the country. He went to England. The evidence that you've referred to, they've only tried to serve him twice. They tried to serve him at his original residence in Florida, which
was in the contract. He had a place of service designation in the agreement.
Correct.
And he took off, and that was vacant when they came, and there was no pre-notice saying, I'm not here anymore where I said I would be in the contract. Here's where I am.
The key issue here is, why didn't the process server appear? And she could have submitted, for instance, Your Honor, you've asked
why
about
is
the
that, no, the other two judges are telling you that is, in fact, not the key issue.
But
the key issue is his credibility when he testifies, because he doesn't put this matter in play if he doesn't give the judge credible testimony. It's as though he had never said a word. The judge says, I just don't believe you. Not enough to move ahead.
With respect to what Judge Kaur said in his opinion, the evidence at trial, I mean, even what Judge Kaur said about the house, that this probably wasn't his residence, that's what Judge Kaur said. And the issue as to whether this man received notice is what's critical here. And that's what this case is about. It is about whether he received notice of the process.
Okay. Well, why don't we leave it at that, and we will hear from
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Sullivan, wouldn't it have been easier, rather than having the pleasure of appearing before us today, to have gotten a better affidavit from Ms. Johns?
Well, clearly it would at this point.
From the UK or anything, you could have just gotten a better affidavit.
I think there are a couple things that explain that. The first is the timing of when this happened. So it's important to understand that the hearing on the motion to vacate took place on February 2nd, 2009, which was a Monday. Prior to that, relational, my client had a pending motion for Ms. Johns to testify by telephone. That motion was denied the Thursday before the Monday hearing, and of course she's in the UK, so my guess is she didn't get word of that till the following morning, because that would have been after the close of business on Thursday. So the reason there's no notary on the affidavit, or at least one of them, is this affidavit was put together very, very quickly. Now, in his reply brief, Hodges asks why we didn't supplement with an affidavit that had a notary signature on it. And the reason is actually very simple. It's just that Judge Kaur rejected the motion for reconsideration before relational had a chance to respond to it. So there was nothing to fix at that point. So I agree with the court. In hindsight, it would have been easier. But there's certainly no reason to believe that Ms. Johns wouldn't have signed a notarized affidavit. She did swear in her first affidavit that she served.
The first one was all right, right?
The first one was all right, and she wanted to testify by telephone, which presumably would have been under oath, too. So she had no compunction about testifying under oath. So following up on the points, actually, that the court raised, Federal Rule of Evidence 103A says error may not be predicated on a ruling that admits or excludes evidence unless a substantial right has been violated. Hodges has not pointed to a substantial right here. And I think when the evidence is looked at in its overall context, the evidence that was in this supplemental affidavit, it shows how unimportant it is. So as the court points out, there were two affidavits. The supplemental affidavit deals only with, or primarily with anyway, Ms. John's ability to identify Hodges' physical appearance at the time that she served him. So there are really two things here. I think the notary itself, because of the first affidavit, the notary block itself, I think, is of diminished significance because, of course, the issue with the notary is whether the testimony is under penalty of perjury. Well, Ms. Johns had already, in her first affidavit, said under penalty of perjury that she served Mr. Hodges and that Mr. Hodges identified himself at the time of service. So a notary in the second affidavit, practically speaking, did not add a whole lot because for it to make a difference in terms of her subjection to penalty of perjury, she would have had to have told the truth in the first affidavit, then lied in the second affidavit, which, one, doesn't make any sense, and, two, if she told the truth in the first affidavit, obviously Mr. Hodges loses the case. So
are you placing any weight? I guess the second affidavit is this one right at the end of the appendix.
Yeah, that's correct.
Where it begins on the first page with capital letters, state on oath, and she does sign it at the bottom of each page, actually. You're not placing any weight. You don't claim that satisfies, say, U.S. law, the statute.
I think that the court, there's a disagreement between various federal trial courts on whether an affidavit like that in itself satisfies the standard to be admitted into evidence. But
yeah, it's 1746. That's the statute.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
But whether an affidavit can be admitted is in the discretion of the trial court. So I would say that the trial court can look at the facts and circumstances of the particular case. I don't see any reason why they can't do that. And here it already had an affidavit where Ms. Johns had sworn that she served him and that he identified himself when he did so. So I think these are different circumstances than the Northern District cases that are cited by Hodges. In Hodges' discussion of prejudice, first of all, in his initial brief, he doesn't discuss prejudice at all, and he doesn't even refer to the content of the supplemental affidavit that he's challenging. In the reply brief, there is a discussion of prejudice, and there's a discussion of plain error, but in that, what he points to as the prejudice is his inability to cross-examine Ms. Johns, and he cites a case called Ray versus Boatwright. The problem is that Ray versus Boatwright is a criminal case that this court explicitly decided based on the Confrontation Clause, which obviously has no application here. To the contrary, there's a long line of precedent, and I think O'Brien is one of the lead cases where this court has said that an affidavit from a process server that attesting to service is prima facie evidence of service that can only be rebutted by, it's not clear and convincing, I think it's like strong and convincing evidence in a motion to vacate a default judgment. So the substantial right that he says was violated is not a substantial right that he has. He had no right to cross-examine Ms. Johns. I'd like to talk a little bit about the waiver issue as well. I don't think it has ever been said that Hodges' motion for reconsideration met the criteria for a motion for reconsideration. Now, in his reply brief, he backs off whether it's a motion for reconsideration, but fundamentally that's what it is. It's an issue that the court had decided the admissibility of this affidavit, and he's asking the court to reconsider that. At trial court, he captioned it as a motion for reconsideration. In his opening brief, Hodges still calls it a motion for reconsideration. It's just hard to see where there's any error, where the trial court decided what Hodges believed was a motion for reconsideration, what I assume the trial court believed was a motion for reconsideration based on the criteria for deciding a motion for reconsideration that I think everybody agrees this motion did not meet. So one more point. In his brief, in the reply brief on page 6, counsel says, the court has held that objections to defective affidavits were not waived even if a formal motion to strike is not raised where the party is put on notice prior to the ruling and there is no gamesmanship in failing to object. And he cites Friedel versus City of Madison. But that's not exactly what Friedel versus City of Madison says. I think what the court says in the specific footnote that he cites is very much consistent with Relational's view of the case. The court says, this court has held that where a party fails to move to strike a defective affidavit or particular portions thereof, the party has waived any objections based on its defects, and the court may, and it italicizes the word may consider the affidavit. Unless the court has any questions, I have nothing further.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Does he have any more time? You can have 1 minute. I'm giving people a minute, but please, a minute. I will cut you off if it's more than that.
Okay. Just 2 points. One is that in terms of the burden that we have on the initial affidavit, I think that when you have an affidavit, which is a bare-bones affidavit, and you confront that with direct evidence and a refutation that event occurred, that service occurred, I think that then shifts to the burden shifting back to the plaintiff, where in this case the judge said, we're going to have an evidentiary hearing. And at the evidentiary hearing, I understand the court's position on this, that the judge rejected the testimony of our client, but that was the only testimony provided at the hearing. They didn't provide any direct evidence at that point at the hearing of service. And the only other last thing is, with respect to the Friedel point, I encourage you to read Friedel because I do believe it stands for the proposition that we state. And in that case, the difference is that there is a line of cases that say if you don't object until after judgment is entered or during appeal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. We will take the case under advisement.